So they respond within 5 hours, and then what?
No, they didn't.
I mean, in the plan, yeah. In the contingency plan.
They said call for containment.
Now, I think before we get technically there, that on the volume that's supposed to be contained, I don't know if it's realistic or not, but the volume is, I better not pull a number on it because I'd be guessing at it, but there is a, supposed to be have equipment to respond to a particular volume spill. I asked that question, I don't know, sort of rhetorically, if you will, but I said, what if someone was sitting there at the reef with an unlimited volume of boom skimmers waiting for this ship to come and spill? Could you stop it? And I'm told if you had a boom that was 25 feet deep, maybe you could have contained that oil that came gushing out of there within that five-hour period. In other words, by the time they got there, even within the response time, most of that had been emptied.
Can I add a second? I'd like to say two things before we lose the topics. One last thing about the use of chemical dispersants, and then I'd like to say something about your sea plans. Chemical dispersants. Zone 1, they're pre-approved, and it's at the discretion of the on-scene coordinator. An on-scene coordinator who's doing his job is going to call up the agencies to get information when he makes that decision. That's a smart thing to do. He doesn't have to consult us. He doesn't have to call us up to say, well, I'd like to do it in Zone 1. What do you think? But if he's doing his job, he'll call, he'll check. We may have information that he'll use. Maybe Fish and Game has some information. Maybe the fisherman will, and he'll put out his feelers. The suggestion I don't want to dump this on, I suppose you shouldn't say that when you're talking about dispersants. I don't want to just shift this on the on-scene coordinator and say that, and suggest that because we had pre-approval, therefore any delays were somehow a problem that he created, because I think the on-scene coordinator does his job when he looks carefully and skeptically at any application of chemical dispersants. Not because they're a bad thing across the board, but just because you want to have them used as surgically and carefully as possible. So if he takes some extra time to make that decision, I think it's unfortunate to try to second guess and say that this was a huge missed opportunity. As long as that on-scene coordinator is doing his job, he's going to be looking at each situation, gathering the information, and making a call. He doesn't have to call us to get new approval in Zone 1, but he sure does in Zone 2 and 3, and we have the authority to come down hard if he fails to do that in Zones 2 and 3, and we wouldn't hesitate. Now, with respect to contingency plans, let me just give you the broad idea of it. A contingency plan is a response plan for a spill. It says what the responsible entity is going to bring to bear to solve the problem, how quickly they're going to do it, and how they're going to carry it out. In this instance, for example, the responsible party was Alyeska. Their contingency plan included, this is just an example, and I'd be happy to show you the plan if you wanted to take a closer look. It included things like a response within 5 hours, even beyond the area where this tanker went aground. It included the use of 7 skimmers, 21,000 feet of boom, and none of those were done. That's why you've heard me be highly critical of what I consider to be a totally unacceptable response on Alyeska's part. When you look at the contingency plan, you'll see that it's much more detailed than I've just summarized it, but that's what it's basically about. Now, there is an important policy issue in all of this, because if you look at how a contingency plan works, the entity that's responsible to carry it out, of course, has the first shot of doing that. And if they fumble the ball, then the next entity that picks it up, whether it's the Coast Guard or the state or Exxon, is starting from behind. And in a situation like this, where you have a massive spill, high velocity winds ultimately, not in the first 3 days, then you've got a big problem. That's why the first hit is so important. It's important to be there and hit that spill hard and hit it early, pick up as much as you can. That's what a contingency plan is all about. And that's why in this instance, you've heard me say it was inexcusable what happened in the early response, but let's put that behind us now. We're going to go back and look at that, find out what it was that was going on. There's going to be a full investigation of why that contingency plan was not carried out. But where we are right now is, what do we do about this Prince William Sound, this highly sensitive, very productive area with 240,000 barrels of oil sloshing its way toward the Gulf. Bear in mind that the recovery of oil in this situation has been only between 1 and 3,000 barrels. We're talking about 1%. That's hardly a vigorous early hit in scooping up the stuff when it could be most easily gathered up and contained.
Kelso?
Our tankers out here watching from side pumps. It's only 5 or 6 inches deep. And chemicals haven't been proved in, I will say, Germany for one place. They say they don't work. So why don't they try that for a change instead of pass the month around on something else like chemicals?
This press conference is rapidly getting out of control.
I'm happy to keep going here, and I promised I'd keep answering questions, but I don't want to burn people out past their deadlines. If you want to keep going, I'm happy to. Or if you want to catch me after we adjourn here, I know that some of the panel folks have to take off. And let me just invite John and others who need to leave. Please do, and I'll stay.
Valdez. I would like to ask, currently the terminal right now, I notice there's a tanker. This isn't for you, John.
I heard you say Valdez.
No, but it's currently at Alyeska right now, there is a tanker at berth 1. I believe it's the Arco Sag River. In light of the oil company and their past spills at the terminal over there, is there any oil spill response equipment left at the terminal? And is the environmental integrity of Valdez going to be sacrificed to get oil to the lower 48? Is there oil spill equipment on place at Alyeska right now so they can load those tankers?
What I'd like to do to give you a more precise answer is to get you together with Dan Lawn from our Valdez office. I hear what you're saying. I believe there is adequate material in Valdez now to make that response. We are expecting Alyeska to maintain a contingency plan and to maintain its contingency plan even if they fail to carry out the plan with respect to the tanker vessel Exxon Valdez. We are going to hold them to be able to respond to any other spills, and we're going to get back to this one and find out what the deal was. We have some enforcement authority, and we're going to evaluate our alternatives under that. We're not prepared to write off protection for the rest of Valdez Harbor just in order to make this response possible. Bear in mind that the personnel that are associated with that response are in place, and it's just a matter of having the equipment and the material. But let's get together afterwards, and we'll get you together with Dan Lawn and give you a more precise answer. That's one of the tasks that we have identified for the Operations and Coordination Group. Very appropriate point to raise, and one that we want to have addressed.
I do have a question. If you could cite an example of what the Operations and Coordination Committee will be doing, and also why you came up with this new management structure. Was something else just not working effectively, or?
An example of the work that the Operations and Coordination Group is doing will be to develop the logistical and other support necessary for the fishermen strike force to do their work. Another is to develop coordinated what's called real-time mapping of the spill and its progress. Another is to develop a method for information sharing, including inventory information, deployment information, and current status between the various entities, that kind of thing. Another is to develop the kind of standby contingency in case the vessel allows some additional oil to escape.
So doing everything to free these other people up to make these larger policy.
That's correct. And also, you know, what we're interested now in is make it happen. And that's why we want that group to move on anything necessary so that what happens in the field is effective.
And this new management structure, was that set up because the previous way wasn't working?
Well,
as I've never been.
The state had wanted to be involved in the actual decisions and the plans and what happened in the field on a daily basis. Well, as distinct from just Exxon, and Exxon had indicated a willingness to let that happen, to welcome that to happen, but we didn't have a structure that would allow it to happen. And if you look at what was happening in the field, you know, obviously Exxon was starting at a disadvantage because the initial response was inadequate. And so then when they picked it up, they had to build a whole organization. That organization wasn't easy for anyone outside that organization to reach into and affect the decisions. So we basically said, look, let's figure out how to do this. Let's integrate this so that we really are signing off on what it is you're going to do, and we really know what you're going to do, so we can use our resources to supplement that, because we had a team ready to go within hours of the spill. We had the capacity to do certain things in the field, some of which we are uniquely situated to do, but we had to be able to coordinate that effectively, or it's like anything, you know. What we're interested in out there is not activity. Towing boom around or boats floating out there is not the point. The point is, how much can we deal with the oil? How much can we actually protect? What can we recover? And how do we do cleanup?
The word using attack the spill was used before. It looks like, to me, if we have 32,000 feet of boom, if you look at, could you estimate the mileage of coastline we're talking about there, where the oil is right now?
We have
roughly 6 miles worth of boom and hundreds, perhaps thousands of miles versus coastline.
There's no way
that you can do more than, say, seal off at this point the three hatcheries and the Sutnet area that you were talking about before. And I think, gee, in my mind, it appears to be a misconception that there's actually any capability at all to attack the magnitude of the spill that's here right now.
There is no way to recover or contain the spill now. That's why the initial response was so important. Once it gets out and is cruising around like that, like it is as it is now, then you're looking at a very different situation. Now we're looking at tactical defensive measures to protect specific small, highly sensitive areas. And we're not, you know, you're not going to be able to, as Jack Lamb said, he's not here now, so I'll attribute it to him. He said, look, Night Island has been hit. We're not going to be able to do anything about that. We've got to move to those things where we can. I think a question was asked earlier, why is it that we're doing this? Well, obviously, if you look at how much oil was recovered and if you look at the current situation, we thought that more needed to happen. We were not satisfied with the way things were.
Right here, so I can get it on this bird.
Sure, how are we doing here?
Just fine.
Am I going to be legal with you if I can do this?
As long as you stick around after.
All right.
And is there any way to deal with a beach cleanup on the rest of the coast that we're not going to be able to protect here in this, what I would call the last line of defense where we are right now? I just got back from Dutch Harbor, and, you know, the bay there is just every time the tide comes in and goes out, it leaves a new layer of oil on the beach, and that was from a 30 or 40,000 gallon spill. I'm sure you're aware of that. Are we looking at many Dutch harbors all around these affected areas right now? How can anyone possibly get on the beach and collect that oil?
It's a massive task and a very good question.
How long are those booms going to happen?
I want to say one thing to you, and that is that the governor will be, of course, here later, as I mentioned, and he does want to be available to the press. Probably if the federal officials conduct a press conference, we'll join that, but he will be available to you. And he specifically authorized me to do whatever we needed to do to get this thing on track.
What's his position?
President of Cordova District Fishermen United.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to call it a wrap. This is Dave Hammack. We've been broadcasting a marathon press conference from the Valdez Civic Center Ballroom. The press conference was organized under the auspices of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. The last voice we heard speaking was Commissioner Dennis Kelso. Also in the press conference, we heard Jack Lamb, who I've been erroneously identifying as vice president. He is the president of the Cordova District Fishermen United, CDFU, the largest and most active of the fishermen's organizations for Prince William Sound. We also heard from the mayor of Valdez, John Devins, from Larry Dietrich, who is the Director of Environmental Quality for the State Department of Environmental Conservation. We heard from Admiral Ed Nelson, who is the Commandant of the 17th Alaska Coast Guard District, or 17th District of the Coast Guard, which is all of Alaska. And we heard from Jack Arasi, who is the President of Exxon Shipping. The fairly grave news at the beginning of the conference from Dennis Kelso is that the spill is basically out of control and there is serious damage to coastal war waters, the beaches along the islands in the southwestern area of Prince William Sound. The state has taken a much more aggressive role in taking over control of the response. There is a new management structure where the Coast Guard, DEC, Admiral Nelson, Dennis Kelso, and Frank Arasi are a steering committee. No actions will be taken by Exxon or anyone else without approval of this committee of three. There's also a working group. There's a working group of people who will be the operations and coordination committee. Representatives on that committee include DEC, the State Department of Environmental Conservation, the U.S. Coast Guard, Department of Fish and Game, and Fishermen. CDFU will be represented as well. And Exxon, of course, and the City of Valdez is participating in this operations and coordination group. So the spill is what has been identified are four specific areas in southwestern Prince William Sound that are critical to the commercial fisheries interests. One extremely rich environmental area is Chamois Bay and the three large fish hatcheries. Prince William Sound has really led the state in the successful mariculture using hatcheries to augment the natural salmon runs. The hatchery salmon, hatchery pink salmon run for Prince William Sound almost equals the entire wild pink salmon run for the entire state. Three of these five hatcheries are directly threatened by the current direction and extent of the spill. Those are areas referred to as Main Bay, Port San Juan, and Esther Island. DEC will be coordinating efforts by a Fisherman's Strike Task Force, also referred to as the Mosquito Fleet, and vessels under charter to the state and some of the vessels working with Exxon to move booms rapidly into these four areas. This area has also been referred to by some at this conference as the last line of defense to protect these important hatchery areas. As of right now, hundreds of millions of tiny salmon fry, the young salmon, are being released. This is the scheduled time of the year when they must be released to complete or to start their salmon life cycle. These fish fingerlings, or salmon fry, I should say, will be remaining in the estuary or intertidal zone areas around the hatcheries for about 4 weeks. It is felt if they can be held in those areas and protected once they're released from the hatcheries from oil into Main Bay, Esther Bay, Chamois Bay, or Port San Juan, that there is a possibility that within 4 weeks, the cleanup efforts, burning, and just the movement of oil out to the Gulf may be enough that the salmon run will not be catastrophically impacted. That is the priority of the state DEC at this point. Also, those are the primary bits of information or new information that has come out. There was considerable discussion over the various roles of the different agencies. It's becoming a bit frustrating, I'm sure, for those who are on the podium, also for those here in Valdez and Cordova who have been following these events since the very beginning. As each new wave of national media arrive, they have to start from ground zero to be educated. So we're hearing the same questions asked over and over again for the last 5 days. There seems to be a great bit of confusion today about the events regarding the decision to use aerial-delivered dispersants. Everyone here today seemed to have forgotten that on Sunday when they were testing the dispersants, a day that has been referred to in this press conference as the missed best chance, the water was virtually calm in Prince William Sound. Chemical dispersants require some agitation, some wave action to be effective. The initial tests on Friday afternoon and initial test on Saturday morning indicated that the dispersant was not effective, primarily because there was no wave action. This was the time when mechanical cleanup or booming would have been most effective because the weather was uncharacteristically cooperative at that time. At the conferences and the meetings and the briefings held on Friday evening and Saturday morning and Saturday evening, This was discussed at some length on Sunday. They finally got the go-ahead. They finally had a successful test late in the day by increasing the concentration of dispersant. The wind picked up. Unfortunately, it picked up to a greater extent than predicted, and to a point where dispersants were not effective because there was so much agitation, there was too much wind, and flight conditions were unsafe. We are anticipating later in the day a series of meetings. The Coast Guard has scheduled an afternoon briefing at 4:30 Alaska time. At 5 o'clock, Exxon is scheduled to have a briefing again. However, this should be short, as the Exxon personnel, at least some of them, are scheduled to fly to Cordova for a community meeting this evening. We have received word that NOAA, which had scheduled a press conference this evening at 8 p.m. Alaska time, they have canceled. The NOAA press conference at 8 p.m. has been canceled. KCHU is working at this point to find a way, if we can, to broadcast the City of Cordova meeting this evening. We don't have the technical facilities available in Cordova, but we understand efforts are being undertaken by CDFU and other members of the Cordova community to provide an audio feed. If that does work, we will broadcast that meeting if at all possible. We're working on that now. Also, we have received a couple of other requests. Alice Berker, who is with the Bird Rehab Program located in the Valdez Community College, is asking for smelt. We understand that over in western Alaska, there are smelt are running. They need smelt on hand, already to be here when fish come in so they can feed the birds, wild birds, the oiled birds that will be brought in for cleaning and rehabilitation. The request has been made that if there are people out in western Alaska who are willing to donate some of the fresh smelt catch, they should be frozen and sent to Valdez as soon as possible. We don't have a phone contact at this point, or we are trying to get a phone contact. If there are those in western Alaska who may be able to provide some fresh smelt, I don't know any idea of the quantity, but certainly will. If a lot of birds are recovered alive and oiled, they will need, of course, quite a bit of feed. The number in Valdez is 835-5148, 5148. We'll be repeating this information throughout the day on our broadcasts. Again, this marathon press conference is finally over. We'll continue to provide you live coverage as we are appraised of the meetings that are occurring in Valdez. Tonight, the big news is that the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Transportation, the Coast Guard Commandant, and the head of the National EPA will be arriving in Valdez. The Alaska State Governor Steve Cooper and the Governor's Chief of Staff Gary Peska were also scheduled to arrive here, but we understand that the governor has been delayed by bad weather in Juneau and may or may not be here this evening. In any event, we will keep you appraised. I wish at this time to thank KCHU staffer Mary Beth Joyce and volunteers. There are numerous volunteers who have assisted us. We do want to continue to thank those at the station, James Winchester and Laura Lee, who have been working at the KCHU, and our reporters, Claire Richardson, and the APRN reporter, Steve Heimel, working in this effort. I'm Dave Hammack. We'll be back with more coverage later in the day. We'll try to advise all stations down the line as to start times for these events. We'll do our best to keep everyone in the know as to what to expect. We'll give you all the warning that we get. For now, this is Dave Hammack at the Valdez Civic Center in Valdez, Alaska. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.